KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
During every single day of the Trump administration, I will very simply put America first.
President Trump has taken the oath of office for a second time and has been sworn in as the 47th president.
It's Monday, January 20th, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. Cecile Richards, former president of Planned Parenthood, has died at the age of 67.
You want to give in to the weariness, and you want to give in to just giving up. And when I'm tempted to feel that way, I think about Cecile.
Also, today is the first full day of a new ceasefire in Gaza. Hamas has handed over three Israeli hostages.
And a conversation with Timothée Chalamet about playing Bob Dylan in the movie A Complete Unknown.
You hear the iron ore in his voice. You hear the North Country blues when he talks. I don't want to lose any part of that.
Those stories after this news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. Some 20,000 people packed Washington's Capital One Arena today to hear President Trump speak in person following his indoor inauguration. Many who went cited what they described as a favorite Trump policy, immigration. Here's NPR's Frank Langfitt.
Joanne Floyd traveled from Mississippi and spent 5 hours in the cold trying to get into the arena on Sunday, only to be turned back. This time, she got in.
The biggest thing that I love about Donald Trump is those borders, and it's sickening, very sickening to see under Biden's administration all of these illegal immigrants coming into the country.
Trump is declaring a national emergency at the southern border and is pledging to deport immigrants who've been convicted of crimes. As COVID-19-era restrictions eased, illegal border crossings rose sharply under President Biden, but are now at their lowest level in recent years. Frank Langfitt, NPR News, Washington.
In his inaugural address, which focused heavily on Latin America, Trump said the U.S. will again consider itself a growing nation that expands its territory, and renewed his threat to seize the U.S.-built Panama Canal. Reporter John Otis says more.
The Panama Canal connects the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans and is a key route for world shipping. It was built and operated by the U.S., but under a treaty signed by both countries in 1977, the canal was handed over to Panama. In his address, Trump insisted that U.S. ships are now being overcharged to use the waterway and claimed, without evidence, that it's controlled by China.
China is operating the Panama Canal, and we didn't give it to China. We gave it to Panama, and we're taking it back.
However, Trump offered no details on how that would happen. And Panama's president, José Raúl Mulino, insisted that the canal belongs to Panama. For NPR News, I'm John Otis.
President Trump, during his inaugural speech, mentioned under his administration there will be only two genders, male and female. Trump also pledged to end federal government diversity, equity, and inclusion programs. In his final moments as president, Joe Biden preemptively pardoned several members of his own family. NPR's Asma Khalid reports it was an unusual move.
In a statement, Biden wrote that his family had been subjected to, quote, unrelenting attacks and threats that he does not foresee ending. And therefore, he was pardoning his brother James and his wife, his sister Valerie and her husband, along with his other brother Francis. He said the issuance of these pardons should not be mistaken as an acknowledgement that they did anything wrong. But it's a sign of the distrust Biden has for the new administration. This despite Biden's longstanding avowal of respect for the rule of law. Late last year, Biden issued a sweeping pardon of his son Hunter, who had been convicted of gun and tax-related crimes. Asma Khalid, NPR News.
This is NPR. The Hubble Space Telescope has completed the most comprehensive survey yet of the Andromeda Galaxy. As NPR's Jonathan Lambert reports, the new images will help scientists understand the history of our galactic neighbor.
The spiral-shaped Andromeda Galaxy is the closest galaxy to our Milky Way, only about 2.5 million light-years away. That's made it tough for astronomers to construct a full picture of Andromeda, because to see it, telescopes need to cover a relatively large swath of the sky. Now, NASA's Hubble telescope has completed the widest look yet. In a study published last week in the Astrophysical Journal, researchers added about 100 million stars in the southern half of Andromeda. It took the telescope over a decade, about 1,000 revolutions around Earth, to collect all of the photos. The analysis will help researchers reconstruct Andromeda's history, which scientists suspect involved collisions with smaller galaxies. Jonathan Lambert, NPR News.
National Women's leader Cecile Richards has died. Richards, the daughter of the late Texas Governor Ann Richards, was diagnosed with a glioblastoma, an aggressive form of brain cancer, in 2023. Richards led the group Planned Parenthood through some of the organization's most tumultuous years. Planned Parenthood has long been a lightning rod for debate and Richards over her 12 years leading the group. Richards spoke at the Democratic National Convention in August and was awarded the Presidential Medal of Freedom in November. Cecile Richards was 67 years old. Crude oil futures prices closed modestly lower today. Oil down 91 cents a barrel to settle at $76.48 a barrel in New York. I'm Jack Speer, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Kresge Foundation. Established 100 years ago, the Kresge Foundation works to expand equity and opportunity in cities across America. A century of impact, a future of opportunity. More at Kresge.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. Well, today, Donald Trump was sworn in as President of the United States for the second time.
I, Donald John Trump, do solemnly swear.
I, Donald John Trump, do solemnly swear.
In his inaugural speech, the president promised a new beginning for the United States.
The golden age of America begins right now.
Repeating a familiar vow to make America great again, Trump outlined his priorities in the coming days and signaled that he would issue a slew of executive actions.
First, I will declare a national emergency at our southern border.
With immigration top of mind, Trump plans to send troops to the border and deport millions of people. He also hopes to end birthright citizenship, a right explicitly protected by the Constitution.
Next, he focused on the economy, saying that he would bring down prices, including the price of energy.
That is why today I will also declare a national energy emergency. We will drill, baby, drill.
Trump also plans to create what he's calling the External Revenue Service. The goal, he says, is to collect tariffs and other revenues from foreign sources.
Trump then turned to diversity, equity, and inclusion efforts in the government, saying he would end government policies created to promote race and gender diversity.
As of today, it will henceforth be the official policy of the United States government that there are only two genders, male and female.
President Trump also invoked the history of U.S. colonialism, vowing to rename the Gulf of Mexico to the Gulf of America and restore Alaska's Denali to its previous name, Mount McKinley.
And we will pursue our manifest destiny into the stars, launching American astronauts to plant the stars and stripes on the planet Mars.
And in the end, he returned to the theme he began with of bright days ahead for the U.S.
Nothing will stand in our way because we are Americans. The future is ours, and our golden age has just begun.
Well, that was just one of many speeches from President Trump today. And here to break down what we heard and saw is NPR national political correspondent Mara Liasson. Hi, Mara.
Hi there.
All right. So what were your biggest takeaways from Trump's inaugural address?
One of them was that there was a lot of continuity from his 2017 speech. This really was American Carnage 2.0. He said the government has a crisis of trust. It's a radical and corrupt establishment. He said he has a mandate to completely reverse a horrible betrayal. He said the government can no longer deliver basic services. He went on to say never again will the immense power of the state be weaponized to prosecute political opponents, even though that's exactly what he's proposed to do using the Department of Justice and the FBI to exact, quote, revenge and retribution against his enemies.
Right.
But it was also a grandiose speech, and I mean that in the technical definition of grandiose. It was excessively ambitious and exaggerating. He said, our power will stop all wars. He said, we're going to have prosperity like we've never had before. He also talked about the Panama Canal, and he said, we're going to take it back.
And also, he said at one point in the speech that he wanted to be a unifier and a peacemaker, right? Like, what do you think he meant by that?
I'm not sure, because this speech was not a unity speech. He did define unity at one point. He said, quote, the entire nation is unifying behind our administration. So it sounds like he defines unity as support for him, kind of like a continuation of I alone can fix it. But there wasn't an olive branch to the other side. There were no bipartisan appeals. It was very base oriented. He said, today is Liberation Day. So this is Trump unfettered. He controls all three branches of government. You could argue he also has the new media on his side. Elon Musk and Mark Zuckerberg up there, prominently seated with Jeff Bezos. So this is someone who feels he has a pretty free rein. He did make a comment. He reached out to the Black and Hispanic voters that voted for him. He said he looks forward to working with them.
I mean, it's obvious, but we should just state, yes, I mean, he did win, and Republicans control Congress and the White House. So in terms of unity, isn't unity his already to claim?
Well, that's what you'd think. He's a legitimate president. He won a sweeping and decisive election. He won the popular vote. He has the power, as you said, to do pretty much what he wants. The only question is how much of this very ambitious agenda will the American people hold him to? In other words, do they care if he brings down prices or not, or if their energy bill is cut in half in a year, as he's promised? We don't know.
Well, he certainly hit the ground running, right? Like, what has he done already? Just catch us up.
The White House has issued a lot of executive actions, some of which you heard him talk about in those bites. Mm-hmm. Sometimes executive orders are nothing more than press releases, but others do carry the force of law, assuming they withstand a court challenge. And he did talk about them in his address. No more asylum program, no more refugee program. He declared a national emergency at the southern border. He's going to have the biggest deportation, millions of criminal aliens. He's going to send troops to the border. He's designated the Mexican cartels as foreign terrorist organizations. He wants to end birthright citizenship, which is enshrined in the Constitution. And he also wants to end what he called the EV mandate. He said, you'll be able to buy the car of your choice now. I think that will come as a surprise to many people who've
All
been
right.
buying the car of their choice.
A lot already, and there's more to come, right? Well, after his inaugural address, Trump spoke to his supporters in the Capitol. Let's take a listen.
2020. By the way, that election was totally rigged, but these are the, that's okay.
Yes.
It was a rigged election. You know the only thing good about it? It showed how bad they are, showed how incompetent.
I mean, what do we make of those remarks? It's a rigged election.
For the most part, he kept his gripes at bay in the inaugural address. But once he was in that less formal setting, he reverted to his list of grievances. He falsely called the 2020 election rigged. Even now, he's won the popular vote and had a decisive victory. He's still relitigating the 2020 election. He wants to rewrite the history of January 6th. So his supporters who stormed the U.S. Capitol become what he called patriots and hostages, not convicted criminals. Here's what he said.
I was going to talk about the J6 hostages, but you'll be happy because, you know, it's action, not words that count. And you're going to see a lot of action on the J6 hostages.
So this really shows you the extent to which his actions could weaken democratic institutions, including the justice system. We don't know how many of the January 6 convicted criminals, including some who viciously beat police officers on the steps of the Capitol, he plans to pardon. But these are people who were convicted by a jury of their peers for ransacking the Capitol in an effort to overturn a free and fair election. And pardoning them would be the first step Trump could take to undermine the rule of law.
That is NPR's Mara Liasson. Thank you so much, Mara.
Thank you.
Today marks the first full day of a new ceasefire in Gaza aimed at ending the war that's dragged on for more than 15 months. Last night, Israel released 90 Palestinian prisoners and detainees just outside of Ramallah in the occupied West Bank. They were released hours after Hamas handed over three Israeli hostages who had been kept in Gaza since the October 7th attacks that triggered the war. NPR's Kat Lonsdorf is in Ramallah and was at that prisoner release last night. Hi, Kat.
Hey there.
What was the scene like last night?
Yeah, it was a really celebratory scene. You know, there were families and hundreds of people there waving Palestinian flags. People were draped in traditional keffiyeh scarves. There were kids, there were balloons, they were eating sweets. People were celebrating not just the release of their loved ones, but also the hopeful end to a brutal and devastating war for Palestinians in Gaza. But it was a long, long wait. People were waiting 7-8 hours outside in the cold.
Wow.
The detainees were finally released around 2 a.m., and then it just erupted into chaos as they were greeted and hugged and hoisted onto shoulders.
What can you tell us about who these people are?
So it was mostly women of all ages and then some boys under the age of 18 released last night, according to the Palestinian Prisoners Association. All of the people released this time were arrested after the war began in Gaza in 2023. The number of Palestinians detained in Israeli jails has more or less doubled since the war began in Gaza. Many, but certainly not all of them, were being held in what's known as administrative detention. That's an ambiguous situation without a sentence or trial. I talked to several family members last night waiting for mothers or daughters who described situations like that, saying that they weren't really sure what their loved one had been arrested for and hadn't been able to get any information. Like Ala Malawani, she was waiting for her 23-year-old daughter to be released. She told me that 5 months ago, Israeli soldiers stormed into their house in the middle of the night, accusing her daughter of posting things on social media in support of Gaza. She said she hadn't been allowed any contact with her daughter since. You know, that's not to say that there aren't people with very serious charges also being released in these prisoner and detainee releases, but many of those are expected in coming weeks.
What have you learned about the conditions in Israeli jails for Palestinians right now?
I've talked to Israeli and Palestinian human rights groups who monitor this, and also several recently released Palestinians from Israeli jails, and all have described very harsh conditions. All say that they've gotten significantly worse since the war in Gaza began. We're talking not enough food, not adequate clothing, very crowded and unclean cells, and it's become difficult, if not impossible, to get legal help. International monitoring groups are not allowed access either. Israel's prison service has defended its treatment of Palestinian prisoners and say that they have a right to file a complaint if they feel otherwise.
As you mentioned, there's a lot more to come in this ceasefire deal. This is the first of several planned releases of hostages and prisoners. So what comes next?
So the ceasefire appears to be holding for its first full day in Gaza, like you said. There's been a surge in humanitarian aid that has entered Gaza, somewhere around 1,000 trucks since the ceasefire went into effect yesterday, and that should continue. Meanwhile, the next hostage and prisoner exchange should be next weekend. We're still waiting on the exact details of that. And negotiations to extend this deal past this initial six-week phase should begin in the coming weeks.
NPR's Kat Lonsdorf in Ramallah, thank you.
Thank you.
Listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Arm, committed to delivering innovative, advanced computing designed to enable worldwide companies to unleash the capabilities and experiences of AI. The future of AI is built on Arm. Arm.com. And from the Kauffman Foundation, providing access to opportunities that help people achieve financial stability, upward mobility, and economic prosperity, regardless of race, gender, or geography. Kauffman.org. This is NPR.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Ailsa Chang. The new biopic, A Complete Unknown, is a snapshot of Bob Dylan in the early 1960s. From his days playing coffee houses in Greenwich Village.
Carina, Carina, get what's on your mind.
To his controversial show at the Newport Folk Festival, leading a brash, electrified band. Timothy Chalamet plays Bob Dylan. He looks and talks like Dylan.
200 people in that room, each one wants me to be somebody else. And they should just let me be.
And yeah, he strums and sings like Dylan, too.
Once upon a time, you're just so fine. Through the bumps of dime in your prime.
When I spoke to Chalamet and the film's director, James Mangold, I asked if it was hard to write Bob Dylan as a character on the page, since he's such a widely mythologized figure. Here's Mangold.
You try and throw away this kind of public perception. You know, it's not that it's wrong or right. It's just these words, mystery, enigma, blah, blah, blah. Because the guy's written 55 albums, right? And toured the world for 60 years. So he's not exactly Howard Hughes. He's giving us books, poetry, screenplays, movies, novels, autobiographies, Christmas albums, you name it, he's put it out. And so the thirst...
And yet
we want more.
Society still regards him as cryptic.
Yeah.
Well, Timothy, I read that you thought you would only have about 4 months to prepare for this role, but because of COVID, 4 months stretched into 5 years. I mean, like, how relieved were you that you got to spend so much more time thinking about Dylan, studying him, imagining being him?
Well, the relief was in relation to how much I kept learning.
Yeah.
You know, what was initially 4 months and where I thought I would have the advantage of playing Bob, not as a member of the Church of Bob in the sense that I wasn't one of these mega fans yet, turned into a 5-year process where I feel I've almost turned over every stone available to me now.
I mean, just so people understand, you had to learn how to sing like Dylan, talk like Dylan, play guitar like Dylan, play harmonica like him, walk and move like him. What was the hardest?
I don't know. It was really a process of osmosis. You know, I don't have categories. I don't have a ruler with different sections of stuff that I'm learning. I really try to do it all at once. And my way in was the music. I love this man's music. These are the songs of life.
Remember me to the one who lives there. She once was a true man.
He's one of the great American artists of our times. I'm sure some of your listeners could speak to it better than I could. That said, I've turned over every stone. I did all the work, like you just described, physicality, behavior-wise. But something we haven't really talked about, I also put on 20 pounds because, believe it or not, I was thinner than the guy, you know?
Thinner than Bob.
You had to fatten up to become Bob Dylan. That's hilarious.
Please see for me if her hair hangs long. That's the way I remember her best.
Jim, why was it absolutely non-negotiable to you that Timothy and the other actors sing and perform everything? I mean, just as you had Reese Witherspoon and Joaquin Phoenix do in Walk the Line.
Well, first of all, it wasn't like I had to fight my actors. I think that I was in total league with them. Of course, it's intimidating, but you want an actor to control the performance, and you don't want at any point where musicality is coming out of their mouth or fingers for it to be a kind of, you know, a little earwig in their ear and some playback, let alone the idea that it would be Bob Dylan's real voice coming out of Timmy's mouth, which would...
It would be so weird.
It would be so weird. Like the in early conversations when like some people in the kind of, you know, executive-y kind of positions and producer positions were nervous I'd be like, just visualize what you're even talking about.
I mean, it's almost more sacrilegious, yeah.
Yeah, but what you have to also recognize is we're making a movie about folk music predominantly, and what is folk music if not authenticity, directness, intensity, honesty? It doesn't take any particular bravery on my part, just common sense, really.
I totally get that. But Timothy, I imagine one of the most daunting challenges of portraying someone as well-known and as revered as Bob Dylan is that audiences will want, they will expect you to be believable as Bob Dylan. I mean, even Bob Dylan recently posted on X, quote, "Timmy's a brilliant actor, so I'm sure he's going to be completely believable as me, or a younger me, or some other me." How
That's
did
great.
You decide, Timmy, what version of Bob Dylan you were going to be without offering a caricature of him?
Well, first of all, I love that post, and I love that post because it's so in Bob's voice. And there was no intellectual decision. Again, I love how Jim put it. This is a movie about folk music and folk musicians. The authenticity needs to be felt. My fear was that you would feel the Purell in a Hollywood reproduction of this period.
Sanitizer.
And yeah. just sort of watered down and crystallized and made sing-songy where it was raw. You know, Bob Dylan had a very bad case of bronchitis in his early 20s that helped make his voice sound the way it is. You hear the iron ore in his voice. You hear the North Country blues when he talks. So I don't want to lose any part of that.
I understand you never got a chance to meet Dylan, right, Timothy?
No,
or talk to him
no,
when preparing for this role. Why not? Like, did you want to? And he said no?
Yeah, I wanted to. I was careful about the way I reached out and not to be presumptuous. I saw him live. I've seen him live twice. And that was, I don't want to say helpful enough. It would have been great to, but it was super educational just to see his energy observed from a distance, you know.
But did he not want to meet with you? Or, like, what was that? Or was that a deliberate choice?
I don't think it's as clear as that. I'll let Jim speak to it, or Jeff Rosen, Bob's manager. But my honest feeling is, as Jim said before, we've gotten something like 55 albums from this man. His contribution to the American artistic scene of the last 60 years is monumental. So if I ever did meet him, I would just say thank you. And not thank you for the role, not thank you for the opportunity, thank you for your work.
Well, Jim, you did get to meet Dylan, right? And the way I understand it, you met with him several times to get his take on the script. Is that correct?
Well, and it came out of happenstance. And three or four times we spent a half day together alone in a coffee shop during lockdown. I felt from the beginning sitting down with him that he saw in the script and the entire intention of our endeavor was pure.
It is sort of interesting to me that Bob Dylan was so cooperative in this project, because he does seem like someone who has conflicting feelings about fame, and I would have imagined a biopic being kind of an uncomfortable idea for him, no?
Yes. I mean, I think Dylan recognized that there was a lack of a kind of agenda to demonize anybody, but just to kind of look straight at everything and let it play.
James Mangold co-wrote and directed the new film, A Complete Unknown. Timothy Chalamet stars in the movie. It's in theaters now. Thank you both so much for sharing this time with me.
Thank you, Elsa.
Thank you. Thanks for the great questions.
Yeah, it's been
Thank
a pleasure.
You so much.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.
Even before he was sworn in for the second time, President Trump promised a lot of quick fixes.
You're going to see executive orders that are going to make you extremely happy. Lots of them. Lots of them.
The president's first day back in office. On the next morning edition from NPR News.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. Coming up, what is in President Trump's day one executive actions?
Well, to start, a lot of new immigration policies.
We will begin the process of returning millions and millions of criminal aliens back to the places from which they came.
First, the newscast.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Duane Brown. Sweeping aside many of Democrat Joe Biden's policies, President Donald Trump is taking aim at gender ideology on his first day in office. Trump outlining a policy during his inauguration speech today for the federal government to only recognize two biologically distinct sexes.
As of today, it will henceforth be the official policy of the United States government that there are only two genders, male and female.
The new policy will require government agencies to use the definitions on documents like passports and employee records, while Trump's second executive order will end diversity, equity, and inclusion programs known as DEI in the federal government. That targets environmental justice programs at the Department of Agriculture and diversity training at the Treasury Department. Well, moments before leaving office, President Biden commuted the life sentence of a Native American activist convicted of murdering two FBI agents 50 years ago. From Minnesota Public Radio, Allison Herrera reports.
Leonard Peltier was serving life in prison for the deaths of two agents during a standoff on South Dakota's Pine Ridge Reservation. Peltier was active in the American Indian Movement, which began as a Minneapolis organization fighting police brutality and discrimination. Nick Tilson, executive director of the advocacy group Indian Collective, called the moment historic.
Leonard Peltier now gets to go home. Every Indian person they ever wanted to do was go home and back to their people. And now he's going to have an opportunity to do that.
Indigenous activists, religious leaders, and human rights organizations had long argued that the 80-year-old Peltier was wrongly convicted. For NPR News, I'm Allison Herrera in Minneapolis.
And you're listening to NPR. The former leader of Planned Parenthood, Cecile Richards, has died following her battle with brain cancer. She was 67 years old. NPR's Sarah McCammon has more.
Cecile Richards was the daughter of the late Texas Governor Ann Richards. Both were known for their unflappable advocacy for progressive causes. Dr. Colleen McNicholas, chief medical officer at Planned Parenthood Great Rivers in the St. Louis area, knew Richards for more than a decade through their advocacy for abortion rights.
I think she really changed the way that the movement engaged publicly. She was a very visible and bold presence. She wasn't afraid to take question, to say the word abortion.
Joe Biden awarded Cecile Richards the Presidential Medal of Freedom in November 2024. In a statement, Biden praised her legacy of fighting for, quote, equality, justice, and freedom. Sarah McCammon, NPR News.
Florida Republican Senator Marco Rubio is the first member of President Trump's cabinet to be confirmed today. The Senate voted unanimously to approve Rubio as Secretary of State just hours after the president was sworn in for a second term. Rubio is a staunch supporter of Israel and a longtime critic of China. The son of Cuban immigrants, he becomes the first Hispanic American to serve as the nation's top diplomat. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Your Part-Time Controller, the nonprofit accounting specialists providing financial management services to support stronger nonprofits who make the world a better place. Learn more at yptc.com/NPR. From the Lodestar Foundation, inspired by the principle that helping someone else less fortunate is a path to a happier, healthier, and more meaningful life. Learn more at lodestarfoundation.org. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Ari Shapiro in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. Some pro-Trump religious leaders liken him to two biblical figures, the ancient Persian king Cyrus and the ancient Israelite king Yehu. The comparisons were used to sway many Christians to vote for Trump. But as NPR religion correspondent Jason DeRose reports, the analogies have some people concerned about what evangelicals expect from a second Trump administration.
One of the many leaders who refers to Donald Trump as a modern version of the 6th century BCE Persian king Cyrus is Lance Wallnau, a conservative preacher in Dallas.
Thus says the Lord to Cyrus, whom I've anointed. Donald Trump has an anointing upon him. The hand of God is on him. Oh, I know a bunch of people say, well, how can you say that? He does this and he does that. Cyrus wasn't even a Jew. He was a Persian.
And among those comparing Trump to the 9th century BCE Israelite king Yehu is Jonathan Kahn, a messianic Jewish rabbi.
President Trump, you were born into the world to be a trumpet of God, a vessel of the Lord in the hands of God. God called you to walk according to the template. He called you according to the template of Jehu, the warrior king. He called Jehu to make his nation great again.
Likening Trump to Cyrus makes sense from a certain point of view, says biblical scholar Christine Henriksen-Garraway, who teaches at the Reform Rabbinical Seminary Hebrew Union College in Los Angeles.
He's seen as a foreign king who was very kind to the Jews and allowed them to return to their homeland.
In the same way that Harry Truman was called a Cyrus figure during the founding of Israel, Garraway points out Trump has been likened to Cyrus for moving the U.S. Embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem.
Trump and Cyrus does not surprise me in the least and makes way more sense than the Trump-Yehu comparison, which is a little bit more almost insidious.
Insidious, she says, because of how Yehu came to power.
He's the king who's known for having a bloody coup and initiating a new era. His coup is against the line of Ahab, who is considered one of the evil kings of the north.
And against Ahab's wife, Jezebel. It's worth noting that evangelicals have compared both Trump's presidential opponents, Hillary Clinton and Kamala Harris, to Jezebel.
The big question with Yehu is just the incredible violence.
Bible scholar Peter Altman teaches at Fuller Theological Seminary, an evangelical school in Southern California.
How does that relate to a modern liberal democracy, where there is some sense of religious plurality? Americans don't live under some type of imperial regime, nor are Christians or evangelical Christians, a tiny minority living in a far-flung diaspora across a huge empire.
Altman cautions that those using these analogies are misrepresenting the current political reality.
The problem that I see is that it becomes so easy to use these texts in a way that calls them in some ways as a support for our own side.
My concern is the taking of the text out of its multiple contexts.
Will Gaffney is an Episcopal priest and professor of Hebrew Bible at Bright Divinity School in Fort Worth, Texas. She asks her students this question about likening any current leader to an ancient king.
What does it mean to read scriptures set in the context of monarchy as inspirational and authoritative in conversation with our system of government?
Gaffney says biblical texts are too complex for easy analogies.
They are not a manual for how to run a nation or a people, though they are often ethical texts on how not to run a nation or a people, how not to behave, how not to conduct oneself.
And Gaffney finds it telling that some evangelical Christian leaders liken Donald Trump to Cyrus and Yehu, but avoid comparing him to a more obvious biblical figure.
Jesus's social policies have come out of favor. So Jesus is not in favor as a model for a national leader.
Instead, some evangelical Christians have chosen as their models for the President of the United States two biblical kings who waged bloody war. Jason DeRose, NPR News.
With the inauguration indoors, President Trump moved his parade and viewing to a new venue, too. While the swearing-in and inaugural address took place at the U.S. Capitol, supporters gathered at Capitol One Arena in downtown Washington, D.C., not far from the National Mall. NPR White House correspondent Danielle Kurtzleben is there. Hi, Danielle.
Hey there.
You spent all day at the arena, and this afternoon, an event there replaced the traditional parade from the Capitol to the White House, culminating in a speech from President Trump. He then signed some executive actions. What did he do exactly?
Well, he signed a stack of actions, nine of them, including one order withdrawing from the Paris Climate Agreement, another freezing federal hiring, another freezing federal regulations. Now, these are fresh. It's going to take some time to understand what some of these will do and how they'll be put into practice. One, for example, is about, quote, restoring freedom of speech and ending government censorship. It accuses the Biden administration of censoring speech online. The actions language says the Trump administration will, quote, identify and take appropriate action to correct instances where freedom of speech was abridged, but we don't know exactly what that means. We're going to be dissecting them in the coming days. But zooming out here, this was an all-day event. People entered the arena this morning. They watched a live stream of the swearing-in. They hung around for some speeches, a parade, and until this evening when Trump finally got here. It has been a long day.
And I know it's winding down now, but earlier today, what did the people you spoke with say? What is the mood among Trump supporters?
Well, happy as you would guess. Now, as with any Trump rally, people waited a long time to get in. Here's one who I spoke to in line for coffee this morning in the arena. His name is Wade Lamberson. He's 24 and he's from Arkansas.
So I got here at 12:30 a.m. and I have not slept. That's why I'm in the line for coffee.
Now, he also told me this thing I've heard from several supporters, which is that Trump's win this time means even more than in 2016. The idea is that this win wasn't just about winning votes, but about defeating what supporters perceive as powerful anti-Trump forces.
It's more about that, not about like just having an opponent and beating them fair and square, but like against the odds, right? We believe things are set up against them.
The overwhelming feeling among Wade and also among other supporters is what you could describe as that Trumpian anger, defiance, but with a heavy layer of joy over it. There's this idea that they're the underdogs, they're embattled, but they won anyway.
You watched his inaugural address there with his supporters in the arena. What stood out to the crowd? What lines did they especially cheer at?
Well, especially anything about immigration. There was a point where Trump said he'd declare an emergency at the border. That got big cheers. Definitely one of the biggest cheers came on a point he made about there being only two genders. Now, that reflects Trump rallies I've been to, because any mention at any rally of there being two genders or mention of who should be able to play girls or women's sports, those always got huge cheers at rallies. And one of my biggest takeaways from sitting through this whole day here, though, is that this is just no longer the conservative party that many of us used to know. It's a party that promotes tariffs, not free trade. It's also a party with a lack of continuity. Now, early in the day, the crowd watched the live stream as people arrived to the inauguration, and former Vice President Mike Pence got booed, former President George W. Bush got booed. What this really means is that this party is firmly Trump's GOP now.
NPR's Danielle Kurtzleben, thank you so much.
Thanks, Ari.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Prescription drug expenses are going way down for about 3 million American seniors this year. That's because the Biden administration capped out-of-pocket prescription costs. Not for everybody, just those on Medicare with some of the highest costs. It's part of the Inflation Reduction Act. Reporter Alex Olgan met a retired nurse who expects the cap will save her $7,000 on a single drug this year.
This year, 70-year-old Judy Aiken is sure she'll be able to afford the medicine she needs to treat her psoriatic arthritis.
You know, we can take a deep breath.
That's because Aiken knows how much it'll cost, $2,000. $2,000 is now the limit for how much Aiken and 53 million other seniors will pay for the meds that they get from pharmacies. For Aiken, that means no more delaying home repairs or skipping doses of the common but pricey arthritis drug Enbrel.
I'm not proud to say this, but there were times when I would delay taking my Enbrel It may have come at a time when we had several financial obligations, which is against, you know, everything I stand for as a nurse.
A study published in the journal JAMA found that in 2022, a fifth of patients on Medicare said they skipped or delayed meds because of cost.
I think the unfortunate truth is that we're all just a scary diagnosis away from needing an expensive drug.
Juliet Kubansky is an expert on Medicare drug pricing at KFF, a nonpartisan health policy research organization.
The cap offers peace of mind, you know, that you'll be more able to afford your medications and you're going to be less likely to have to leave the pharmacy empty-handed.
Kubansky explains this overhaul fixes a gaping hole in the 20-year-old Medicare prescription drug benefit. When Congress created the coverage, lawmakers wanted to offer seniors drug plans while keeping taxpayer spending down. That meant leaving seniors who needed expensive drugs on the hook for thousands of dollars.
You know, the number of expensive medications has increased since then. And so this is, you know, this cap is coming into place at a time when we have prescription medications that can cost tens or hundreds of thousands of dollars a year.
So in 2022, lawmakers came up with a plan to fix this problem. They redesigned Medicare's drug plans and the Inflation Reduction Act. The new design basically means that insurers, which offer these Medicare drug plans, are on the hook for more costs. But when insurers face higher costs, they pass those on to Medicare patients by charging higher monthly premiums. That's what happened this year. So the Biden administration kicked in some money to cushion the blow to consumers, at least for the next 3 years.
It's bad policy. And yeah, I mean, it should be changed.
Brian Blaze worked on health policy for the first Trump administration and is now president of the conservative healthcare think tank, the Paragon Institute. He says, look, only a fraction of seniors, about 10%, spend more than $2,000 on drugs in any 1 year. So while patients like Judy Aiken are seeing big benefits, it's at the expense of other seniors and taxpayers. He wants the second Trump administration to up the spending cap. Fewer seniors on expensive drugs would save money, but in theory, monthly premiums would be lower for most seniors. That might not be simple.
You could see that is going to be politically challenging to raise the out-of-pocket limit.
So it's unclear what the Trump administration will do. For now, though, Judy Aiken is thrilled that she'll be able to afford her medicine and home repairs. For NPR News, I'm Alex Olgan. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
We'll be right back.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. Cecile Richards, a prominent advocate for women's rights and other progressive causes, has died. Richards was best known for her work leading Planned Parenthood through a particularly challenging time. She died this morning at the age of 67 from brain cancer, and her family said in a statement that she was surrounded by family and her ever-loyal dog, Ollie. NPR's Sarah McCammon has this remembrance.
During more than a decade at the helm of Planned Parenthood, Cecile Richards was often called upon to defend the reproductive health organization against attacks from political opponents, including threats to defund it.
All women in this country deserve to have the same opportunities as members of Congress and their families for high quality and timely health care.
That's Richards during a hearing before the House Committee on Oversight and Government Reform in 2015. Richards was born in Texas in 1957, the daughter of Ann Richards, who would later become a Texas governor famous for her quick wit. Cecile Richards drew on that legacy during that often tense hearing.
Ms. Richards, this is my 27th year in Congress. I can assure you I've seen many male witnesses treated much tougher than you've been treated here today.
That's Republican former Congressman Jimmy Duncan of Tennessee questioning Richards.
But surely you don't expect us to be easier on you because you're a woman.
Absolutely not. That's not how my mama raised me.
Right.
Richards and her movement would face mounting challenges in the years that followed, including the election of Donald Trump, who ran for president in 2016 on a promise to overturn the landmark abortion rights decision Roe v. Wade. At the Women's March in Washington the day after Trump's inauguration in 2017, Richards addressed thousands of marchers and promised to fight his policies.
And today we're here to deliver a message. We're not going to take this lying down. And we will not go back.
The next year, Richards announced she was leaving Planned Parenthood. In the years to come, the Trump administration would take steps designed to reduce access to abortion, including cutting off funds for groups that make abortion referrals, like Planned Parenthood, through an overhaul of the Title X Family Planning Program. Over the course of his first term, Trump named three conservative justices to the Supreme Court, who in June of 2022 would ultimately vote to overturn decades of abortion rights precedent. Despite those setbacks and a diagnosis of brain cancer, Richards embodied an indefatigable determination, says former Texas State Senator Wendy Davis.
Her belief is you can't give up before you even start, right? And that it's always worth a fight.
Davis worked closely with Richards during a high-profile battle to defeat an anti-abortion bill in Texas in 2013. She says Richards still inspires her to keep fighting.
You know, you want to give in to the weariness and you want to give in to just giving up. And when I'm tempted to feel that way, I think about Cecile. And I know a lot of people do.
In a post on Instagram in January 2024, months after her diagnosis, Richards described going through a whirlwind of treatments, time with family, and focusing on what was most important, including her continued activism. After all, Richards wrote, as my mother used to say, why should your life be just about you? As her health continued to decline, Richards addressed the 2024 Democratic National Convention. She spoke of the joy of recently becoming a grandmother and the challenges many women have faced since the overturning of Roe v. Wade.
One day, our children and grandchildren may ask us, when it was all on the line, what did you do? And the only acceptable answer is, everything we could.
In November 2024, President Joe Biden honored Cecile Richards with the Presidential Medal of Freedom during a private ceremony at the White House. Sarah McCammon, NPR News.
Time now for My Unsung Hero, our series from the team at the Hidden Brain podcast. My Unsung Hero tells the stories of people whose kindness left a lasting impression on someone else. And today's story comes from listener Virginia Squire. More than 20 years ago, Squire chaperoned a group of middle school students on a tour of England, and she brought along her daughter, who was 8 years old at the time. On the end of their last day in London, something unexpected happened.
We were getting ready to get on a subway at 5 o'clock in the afternoon. We arrived at the platform just as the train pulled in. I was holding my daughter's hand, and I turned to count my students. Suddenly, my daughter let go of my hand, jumped on the train, and the doors began to close. As the train gathered speed, I ran alongside, trying to force the door open. My last image before the train completely pulled out of my sight was of my daughter, her tear-streaked face, her fists pounding on the glass, and a young man completely dressed in black leather with a spiked dog collar around his neck, rising from his seat and moving towards her. Then the train was gone. My students gathered silently in a clump while I searched for an official. I was so shocked, too frightened to cry, when suddenly one of my students appeared at my shoulder. "She's back," she said. I turned and there she was, my little girl. The man in leather had seen what had happened, and at the next stop, he got my daughter off the train and brought her back to me. My preconceived notion that he was frightening was destroyed. I remember looking up at him and then breaking down, sobbing, hugging my sobbing child. When I looked up again to thank him, he was gone. For weeks afterwards, I would break into tears at the thought of what could have been. To this day, I hold his image in my head when I find myself judging someone based on their appearance. I hope he hears this and knows he rescued me from the worst day of my life. He also taught me to be a more accepting person. Thank you, whoever you are.
Listener Virginia Squire. Virginia's daughter believes the man who helped her that day was from Indiana or Minnesota. They hope to find him one day to thank him in person. You can find more stories of unsung heroes and learn how to submit your own at myunsunghero.org.
Support for My Unsung Hero comes from Procter & Gamble, maker of Nervive. Nervive Nerve Relief is designed to reduce occasional nerve aches, weakness, and discomfort in hands or feet due to aging. Learn more at nervivehealth.com.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Progressive Insurance. Progressive is looking for dedicated and forward-thinking individuals to join their growing team. More information, including application, at progressive.com/careers. From Procter & Gamble, maker of Align Probiotic, a daily supplement designed by gastroenterologists to help relieve occasional bloating, gas, and abdominal discomfort. More at alignprobiotics.com. From Dignity Memorial, helping families protect their loved ones and gain peace of mind by planning cremations and funerals in advance. Dedicated to professionalism and compassion in every detail. More at dignitymemorial.com.